At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degrees Boiling Hot Water straight from your kitchen tap. This gadget, the boiling tap, the cooker, it's the best. I use mine multiple times a day, whether it's for making tea, coffees, I do a little Americano with mine, cooking. Oh, it's great for cooking. Your veg, your pasta, your rice, your potatoes, your spuds. Mine's always on the go from morning to night. With a gap in between, in the middle of the day. Actually, I suppose there isn't a gap really, because I have probably coffee after lunch. Anyway, if you can afford one, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details and to look at the different styles. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R.co.uk. Today, I'm curious about what emotions are. I think this is going to be fascinating. We bang on about emotions all the time, don't we? How are you feeling? How emotional are you? But what exactly are they and what are they for? Joining me to discuss this is Dr. Dean Burnett. Dean is a neuroscientist who's been on the podcast a couple of times before. I think last time he was on, I seem to remember we discussed what depression is. So he's written a book called Emotional Ignorance, Lost and Found in the Science of Emotion. This book's been brilliant, actually. It really got me thinking about emotions and what we go through and how they manifest themselves. And let's speak to Dean about it. He'll tell us all about it. Here's Dean Burnett. Hi, Dean. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Dean. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Nice to speak to you again. We seem to speak to each other regularly these days.
Yes, so. And I approve of that. It's always nice to communicate. Yes.
Every few years when you've got a new book out, or few months, you're doing one a year at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, I do seem to churn them out.
But they're always great, and they always get me thinking. I love this one. I was just saying in the intro that we never really think about emotions. We talk about them constantly. I mean, we must all talk about emotions every day and everybody else's emotions. But to actually do some analysis what they are and where they're from and what their purpose is such a great idea for a book. What made you come up with the idea for the book?
Well, it's a bit of a weird story in that it initially was meant to be a far more lighthearted, breezy affair. Because I wrote my previous book, The Happy Brain, and people reacted quite well to that. But one of the questions I kept getting was, why just happiness? Why not a different emotion? Which, in a way, you could take that as a criticism, because they were saying, like, why did you write this book? Why didn't you write a different book? Well, thank you for that. That's charming. But they didn't mean it like that. They meant that as, you know, I want to know more. So I thought, well, clearly there's an interest in, in like different emotion stuff. So I thought, well, why don't I try to do a book about all of them? Thinking, like, oh, because at the time, my understanding of emotions was confident, but I'll say rudimentary, because, as I'll get to in a minute, I had been led to believe that the science was very well established, quite settled, and, easy. In terms of complex neuroscience stuff, I thought they were a simple thing. So I thought, yeah, I'll do it, like a nice, easy, breezy book about the emotions. You know, I'll do a chapter on fear and anger and stuff. It'll be straightforward. We'll have a nice time. No problem. Agreed to do it, and then sat down to start writing it, and very quickly realized that the science was not established. In fact, most scientists still don't agree what an emotion actually is, in terms of there's no definition. So the idea of understanding them perfectly is a long way in the future, and there's a lot of debate and controversy and discussion, arguments about what goes where and how it works and stuff. And I realized I'd bitten off more than I could chew on a grand scale. I think I'd said a bit of more than I can chew, like a man who fancies a steak biting an angry bull. And like, okay, that, yeah, okay, you've really overstepped the mark here. So I was all, you know, I did like 3 or 4 drafts, and I just couldn't get to grips with the actual science of it. I think I might have been beaten here. I think they've gone beyond what I know. So I was going to throw in the towel and say, like, I can't do this. I'm going to have to do something else. But then 2020, the pandemic hit. And while at first I was quite confident that I'll be able to, you know, ride it out quite nicely, because I've got my own outside office. I've been working from home since 2018. You know, people wanted to know about the psychology of lockdowns and stuff. I got a lot of work coming my way. I'll be fine. I'll be set. This will be relatively easy for me compared to others. And then in the first, almost first month of the pandemic, my father contracted COVID, recovered a bit, got worse, recovered a bit, got worse, and ended up having to go to hospital because he wasn't getting any better. And he succumbed to the virus in April of that year. And I had to, I couldn't see him. I couldn't go help him. I couldn't be there for my father in his last days. Totally unexpected. He was 58 years old. Very young parents that mine were when they had me. And I, he lived in different cities, so I couldn't go. I literally could not leave because of lockdown, which I agree with and supported as a measure, but it made everything nightmarishly hard. And then he died. And I had to sort of endure that unexpectedly. It's like one of the worst things I've ever done, personally, from my perspective, is say goodbye to my father for the last ever time in my life and his life over a WhatsApp call with 20 minutes notice from my kitchen on a Saturday morning when I'm in my pajamas. And that wasn't how I ever expected to have to do it. And I know I'm a writer, but even then, with 20 minutes notice for that sort of situation, I mean, words are hard to come by. And that was basically it. You know, that's all. Like, that was the goodbye I could give him. And so I was left then with a head full of incredibly powerful emotions, grief fueled, and nowhere for them to go. Like, I couldn't do any of the traditional things you do when you lose someone close to you. There was no sort of family coming around to comfort you, or, you know, helping you with the kids, or taking care of housework, let you, you know, process things. There was no meeting friends and loved ones to share stories and things. There was not even going to the pub and drowning your sorrows, and it's a short-term solution, but it wasn't an option. And I had small children at home, so I couldn't take time, just take a few weeks to myself and disconnect, because I had to be a father to my small children because they were suffering during this situation as well, and that's my job. So I had to just power through, and it wasn't healthy. It wasn't a good thing to do. I just didn't have any choice in the matter. So the only outlet I ended up having was realizing, well, I've got to write a book about emotions because I've agreed to do that, and now I've got a head full of extremely powerful emotions with nowhere for them to go. So basically, given that I've got nothing to do, nothing else to do, and no other options, I'm just going to assess my own tumultuous emotional state and see if I can pin down what's happening to me and why and where is this coming from. And that gave me motivation. It gave me sort of a focus, a hook to write. I don't just want to know about emotions. I want to know about mine. I want to know why has this happened to me? What's going on? Why does this occur, this complex process when we lose someone? What's going on in our heads to make this happen? Mm-hmm. And it all stemmed from me. And that's the book we've got. I was very emotionally ignorant, and hopefully writing the book helped remedy that. So that's where we are.
Do you know what's interesting about that? My father died last year, and he had cancer, and when we knew it was kind of terminal, I was able to go and see him pretty much on a daily basis for a couple of months, and go to the hospice as well, you know, where he was for his final days and stuff. And there's something really nice about that. As you say, you didn't get a chance to say goodbye, whereas I did, because I went to him the whole time. We sat and we chatted and we talked about things, and so it didn't, when he eventually died, it didn't feel as bad, because you have a chance to say goodbye to someone. So I understand what you're going through that. Well, I don't understand it, but I, I know, I, yeah. You know, it kind of I had that wonderful opportunity, and I hate the fact that you didn't manage to have that at all because of the lockdown. And I was listening to a rabbi the other day on I don't know, radio or podcast or something, and he was saying the biggest problem they had during the pandemic was in the Jewish faith, when someone dies, they have a procedure to go through to help with the grieving process. And, you know, he was going through the various stages of the funeral and the getting together and the throwing the earth on the coffin and everything else. Mm-hmm. He talked through it very briefly. I've been to a Jewish funeral, and they're a lot more in depth than, I mean, I don't have a religion, so I had nothing like that to turn to. And he said when people didn't have that, suddenly they didn't know what to do with their emotions, because it's been through centuries, you know, that they've been working a way of dealing with the grief and everything. So you kind of, you end up with just this lost grief, don't you? Sort of whirling around inside you and not knowing what to do. The pandemic was horrific for that, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my position is even unique. I mean, there are millions of people in this country alone who have experienced pretty much the same thing, because we lost the 700,000 people, and every one of those will have a number of loved ones who didn't get to see them in their dying days. And
just to interrupt you quickly, Dean, which is why when the politicians who are in charge at the time say, I think people are over that now, you know, and they go, let's move on. Come on, we need to move on from this. It's like, no, they still haven't, because they didn't get to go through the processes that we want to go through as humans whilst you were having a party. And
absolutely,
I think that,
yeah.
And I think that's where the anger is so much. They didn't know what people like you were going through and how horrific that is for you. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, but that's exactly the point of this. I mean, even if they were completely respectful and completely sort of appreciative of what people went through, which I sincerely doubt, maybe there's one or two, but yeah, that's a whole other discussion. But these things, even in the best of times, it can take several years for someone to get over the loss of someone, particularly if it's a traumatic loss. To expect a good chunk of the country, like millions of people, like I say, to turn them and say, yeah, but that was like last year, so that's, stop talking about that now. And it's not something which is, entirely as the politicians. I mean, I've, a year on from my father's passing, I was trying to talk about it and saying, I'm one of those people who are like a year on from grief during the lockdown and pandemic. Where are we at? But people weren't interested. People like the people in the media I know, or like media sources, they were just saying like, yeah, but that's pandemic. That, we've done that now. Mm. And I get they have their own focuses and their own sort of impetus to keep people interested and reading things. I mean, if people don't want to read about it, then that's bad for their model. I get that. But it's still got a very deeply stark and cynical thing to be told that, yeah, I know you're still grieving, but people are bored of that now.
Yeah.
But people on other people's behalf, like, no one ever told me that personally, but that was the gist I was getting. Mm. And when it's the media, you can sort of understand. I don't like it, but you can sort of get, when it's politicians essentially saying, yeah, your suffering is actually inconvenient for us now, and that's a lot to take, when you're constantly. It's not like it was a one-off. It was like every day for several weeks. And yeah. We know you were sad at the time, but we were bored. We wanted a drink, so come on, be reasonable.
No, we were working really hard, so we deserved it. That's what the rest of us weren't. The rest of us were just having a good laugh.
Chilling. Sourdough bread for some reason.
Yeah, we were just chilling. Yeah, for sourdough and banana bread, and just having a great time while you were working really hard. Yeah, no, I think it's really disrespectful, and I do think those, but they need to hear more stories from people who went through grieving periods during the pandemic, because I think, and especially when you couldn't visit people. I mean, I think that's what they went through, what people have gone through, is horrific. Okay, so what are emotions? Let's go right in with the big question. What, because I know you don't know all the, but what are they? What do you think they are?
Well, I think, based on everything I've read so far, I mean, like my friend Dr. Richard Firth Godby, he's got his own book about emotions, and he says, because he works in the field a lot. Worked with you a lot longer than I have. He said, when you, there are as many definitions of emotions as there are people who are researching it. Then there's more, because they keep changing their minds as well. So maybe there's twice as many definitions. So it's hard to sort of, but it's one of those things like art. People say, I can't describe it, but I know what it is. I recognize it. I guess like they, in the evolutionary sense, they are almost like the progenitor of thought. Like when you have a thought, articulate a thought in your head, it's sort of like it's got a begin and end, and it's a structure to it. And but an emotion is like the origins of that. It's your brain reacting to and interpreting something that's happened to you, something you've perceived. So when you say like, oh, that thing is bad, I am scared of that, or I am angry about that, it's a primitive way of your brain to interact with the world, really. It's like your brain, or any creature's brain, really, because a lot of creatures have emotions, saying, okay, this has happened, what's the correct response here? And although it's not as, you know, they're not as complex as thoughts, and they're not as, you know, rich and detailed in many ways, they're a lot faster, they're a lot more powerful in many in other ways, because they are so fundamental. So, you know, our thoughts, it's believed that our thoughts emerge from emotions, our ability to think emerge from emotion systems, like, you know, like a mushroom from the stem, or like from the rings of a tree, just like evolved from it. So yeah, they are, you know, they are the sort of, they're essentially the color to our mind. They add detail and impetus and motivation to the things we experience. They're our brain's fundamental way of responding to whatever happens to us. I realize this isn't it's not the most concise summary, but there's a lot to be said about them.
Yeah, you know? I suppose that they initially were around to keep us alive, were they? I mean, I imagine. Yeah, just because I just thinking about it there, and I know we had a whole discussion on depression once on this podcast, we artificially, we love I call it emotional tourism, but I think I think the actual definition of that is not what I mean it, but I say every time you watch Netflix, you're watching Jeffrey Dahmer eat people or something like that. It makes you feel emotional, or your love story, or you're watching comedy, or whatever you're doing, it makes you feel that. And I think we are possibly putting ourselves into artificial fight and flight mode every time we go onto our mobile phones, aren't we? And I wonder if we're unable to. I'm deviating here slightly from your book, but I wonder if we're unable to keep having these emotions constantly. We're not supposed to, you know. It's like we're not supposed to feel like we're going to be eaten by a lion every single minute of the day. And I wonder if that's with the smartphone and the jealousy we're having and the anger and the anger. If you're just interested in the royal family at the moment or Prince Harry, I'm sure if you go onto, I mean, I'm avoiding it, but I'm sure if you go onto social media, you're going to get angry by listening to people's different views on the way this is playing out. You know, you're artificially doing it. Surely that's not good for us emotionally.
Almost probably, try that again. I'm pretty much certain that it's not good for us. No, I would totally agree with that. It's, it's one of those balancing acts again, in that I think I discussed in the book about pretty much all forms of entertainment or art. They are designed to invoke a certain sort of emotion. And because of the way our brains work and our emotion systems work, experiencing emotion is an essential part of processing it, of dealing with it, which is why interesting statistics like people who are heavy metal fans tend to be the least angry people, not because they are just monk-like or something, but because the music they listen to is regularly engaging the anger parts of their brain, so they experience it. But that means like that part of the brain is used more, so they can handle anger better than your average person, because they've just spent more time doing it. So there's an argument to be said there that, well, when you experience these things, it makes your brain better at dealing with them. But you're right in that, you know, constantly triggering the same emotions over and over again, the same powerful ones, with a sense of futility to it as well, that's going to be bad, in that you go online and you see someone, you know, argue about the royal family. But I've been angry at the whole Prince Harry thing today, purely because I didn't know he was releasing a book at the same time as mine. So obviously that's not been ideal for me personally, but I don't take it as if he meant that or something. I don't think that reflects on him as a character. But that's purely personal. But you know, it's, you know, social media is designed to quickly and effectively trigger these responses, because that's how you get people involved, people engage, get the clicks and the eyeballs. But yeah, I totally agree that it's not ideal, and our brain hasn't evolved to experience emotions like in this format, in this way. Like I think I mentioned the book, but I mentioned also about doom scrolling when you're on Twitter or Facebook or any sort of feed, and something bad is happening in the world, like the January 6th interaction, you know, the pandemic, and you just constantly look at regular updates because your brain has been told, okay, bad thing is happening. it hasn't finished yet. And because of the way our brains work, we don't like leaving things unfinished, especially when they're bad things. We need to know, what's the end to this? I need to know this is resolved. Otherwise, it's just a constant threat looming over me. But because of the way social media works, it never ends. It's always been updated. It's always novel. The only way they feel end is if society ends. So that's not great.
I suppose also what we're trying to do is learn, because we need information, don't we? So if we are going on, say there is a tragedy. I remember the first time this ever happened to me. I've said this before on the podcast, and so excuse me, listeners, if I'm boring you, but when Versace died, I was sitting at Sky Sports and I had a TV on my desk. It was the same helicopter shot going over his mansion in Miami with a bloodstained bit outside the front of his house. And I reckon I sat and watched it for 4 hours. Nothing new happened, but I couldn't look away. And I remember thinking, I love this 24-hour news. I couldn't get enough of it, and I wanted to. And I was also tuned into the sports channels as well and listening to all the gossip going on there. And I realized that I became a junkie from then. And then my addiction to my smartphone and everything has just carried on since. And I now spend the whole of my time trying to work out how to get off my smartphone addiction. But I am aware that if I do try and engage in a debate about the royal family, then it will trigger all these sort of emotions and it will start that roller coaster. So I try and just avoid it. I mean, I'm not that interested in what's going on there. Well, I am interested in it. I just don't want to get involved in it because there's nothing I can do about it. So I don't. But yeah, it's the other thing about emotions, though, very early in your book, you mention is the fact that obviously, you know, you want it to be just in the brain, because that makes it easy and concise for you as a scientist. However, it's not, is it? We don't really know where emotions are. What do you know about that?
Well, yeah, it's a common question I get asked in the sort of, especially the build-up to this book being released, in that, people think it's a sensible question, and objectively you could say it is, but the question is, where in the brain do emotions come from? And the answer we have so far is, pretty much all the brain, all of them is linked to it in some way, shape, or form, and not even just the brain. Like, the body gets involved a lot too. what the arrangement is hard to really pin down. Again, because we talk about the whole body and brain system, and it's common for people like me, and I know I've done it, to say things like, "Oh, the brain and body," as if they're like distinct things. Like the brain is like a sort of a really wrinkled pilot in a big meat vehicle. And it's not quite like that. There's a lot more overlap than most people assume, which is why things like to differentiate between mental health and physical health problems, it's helpful in ways that it makes people understand these things, but it's not actually accurate, because both physical and mental health problems have a lot of mental and physical side effects respectively, because the brain and body are far too intertwined. They're not separate, like neighbors sharing a garden fence. They are the same thing in many ways. So you get lots of physical consequences of emotions. The Stoics from ancient Greece, they were like the first to identify emotions as actual physical things, because they said when you have an emotion, or whatever they called it at the time, a passion or a yearning or an appetite, you have a physical effect. So when you are scared, like your skin goes white because the blood rushes away, and you clench up, and your stomach starts making weird noises, and all that sort of stuff. Or when you're angry, you turn red and you're trembling because your body is reacting to things. And the one thing I focus on in the book is crying, tears, a physical manifestation of an emotional state. And it's not just like because you're so stressed or tense that your eyes leak. It's the tears that you produce when you're crying from an emotional cause are chemically different to the ones that you get when like you're chopping onions or got something in your eye. So there's clearly something deeply, fundamentally physical happening when we experience an emotion, because they are so heavily intertwined with how we interact and communicate and connect with other people, our fellow species, and other animals too, because we are a very open and engaging species. And emotions are such a big part of how we connect and how we interact that they have so many physical traits as well.
Yeah, expand on that, because I remember reading this in your book. There's obviously emotions for yourself, like you say, fear or anger, and then they're important for other people around you to know how you feel. But the one with the tears was really interesting, because isn't it to let other people around you also know that you're upset? What is it actually in tears that can do that?
Well, it's from the from the outside, it's like tears you can see, as in you can see someone crying, you know they're in an intense emotional state. So that initially that's what people thought. Well, they're just an evolutionary way to signify that someone is in an emotional state and either they need help if they are upset or sad or something, or they are happy. Like you cry happy tears and they might want to share this happiness. So we are compelled to sort of interact and engage with people who are crying in a sort of in an instinctive way. Not to, I know these days social norms mean that someone's crying, you give them some space or stuff. You know, we've moved on since the primitive tribal days, but that's the theory. But knowing that they are chemically different, they contain things like oxytocin and other chemicals which affect our mood. Someone else's tears can affect in a very low-key way our mood. So, you know, when you see someone crying, then you inhale the evaporated tears and you might feel a bit more friendly towards them because of the chemical that's in them. Or it might be for their own sake. So, you know, someone leaks oxytocin onto their skin and it gets absorbed and they feel more open and emotionally engaged because that's what that chemical does. But it's in such sort of small doses, it's, you know, it's not going to do a great deal. It's just be something which helps a little bit. But so much of our emotional expression is so dependent on other people being part of it. You know, empathy, sharing emotions. We have so much, you know, so much going on in our brain, which is dedicated entirely to that, to pick up on the cue someone else is doing. I mean, that came up during the pandemic a lot. Like people saying they do a lot of video calls, like we're doing now, but it's not the same as having a face-to-face interaction. And it can't be, because Zoom calls are good, and being able to see someone face-to-face and have the chat that you wouldn't, it's better than doing it over text, but you're still missing a lot. Like someone's tone, someone's mannerism, someone's body language, someone's just physical presence. Your brain has evolved to pick up on so much detail and information from someone just physically being there. And being denied that means like the brain's already getting half of what it wants or needs when it comes to interaction. So the emotional reaction you have to it is going to be less satisfying, less less profound, or less nourishing, if you want, for want of a better description. And that is what we evolved through. Like you mentioned, like emotions which are social in nature, things like embarrassment. Embarrassment doesn't make any sense if you're on your own. Like you can't be embarrassed when you're by yourself. Like I've used before. If I was in the bathroom getting ready to go to a shower and all my clothes suddenly fell off,
yeah,
I think that's weird. Suddenly, I need to see my tailor. Because clearly that's right. But I'll get in the shower. I won't mind. If I'm in the middle of a supermarket and that happens, I'm absolutely mortified.
Why are you wearing a towel in the middle of a supermarket, Dave?
Well, exactly. Anything. Just my clothes just suddenly evaporate off of my back. That suggests I have a lot of sweat problems, perhaps. But the fact that other people being there means I experience a very different emotional reaction. It's like people like to sing in the shower. Back to the bathroom. I don't know why I keep going back to bathrooms for analogies, but that just seems to be where my head goes in this context. People sing in the shower, they're quite happy to. The acoustics of the bathroom is quite fun and all that. But singing in front of other people, a lot of people just physically cannot do it. They just find it terrifying. And the only difference is other people are there to witness it. So other people's presence causes a profoundly different emotional response because we are such social species and our brains just work that way.
Yeah, though you can artificially bring up emotions by using, I assume it's your memory, but, I can remember I've done plenty of things on TV which embarrass the hell out of me and plenty of things in real life as well. And I can bring those back up to a better example rather than that is anger. I can bring anger up really, we all can. We just got to think of that asshole who did us wrong. Whenever it was, and you can bring it back up, and you can relive those emotions quite strongly, can't you? Immediately, if you bring it up. So do we think that the brain is responsible, the thought process in the brain is responsible for making these emotions happen?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, like I mentioned just now, that the brain deals with emotions, like process them, the memory of them, and the experience of them fits it into our sort of just general mental state. Gradually and over time, if it's a particularly strong emotion. But in order to do that, it has to re-experience them, because it's almost like the same neurological system which produces the emotion initially is needed to work it into your mind, into your mental state. So in order to effectively deal and integrate an emotion into our sense of self, we have to relive it to a certain extent. And this is why PTSD is such a big problem, because people have had a massively profound traumatic emotional experience, but it's too profound, it's too traumatic for them to re-engage with it. You know, people with PTSD, they will avoid all things connected to the incident, whatever it was, and they'll stay clear of it, which is obviously healthy for them on a day-to-day basis. It doesn't like set them off. They don't have a debilitating emotional response. But it means, because the trauma is so potent in this case, that the brain doesn't get a chance to into it, to work on it, to sort of chip away at it and fit it into your system eventually. And that's why things like therapy come into it, or even things like listening to sad music. They give your brain the chance to work on these emotions which you've got stored up. And that's why bottling up is such a bad idea, because, I mean, it can be essential, it can be necessary, because you need to be able to function. But over the long term, it causes more problems than it avoids, because our brain doesn't get the opportunity to work on these things, to work through them, and to be able to effectively integrate them and process them into our identity. This is a part of who I am now, this experience. So yeah, so it's really important to be able to trigger these emotions. That's one theory I think I discussed in the book, that's where dreams and nightmares come from. It's your brain taking a memory of an emotional experience and the main mind is unconscious. Now I can work on this and try and fit it into our memory system in a safe and helpful way. So I'm going to take away the different components, one of which is this blob of fear, which from this stressful memory. Now, if I activate the memory again, they'll be afraid again. So I'm going to have to put this somewhere else. And so you get the experience of fear connected to different things, like typically losing your teeth or being naked in an exam and stuff. All these things which are not as traumatic memories. But it's sort of like diluting the fears. And I'm going to connect this to pre-existing less frightening or less traumatic or less troublesome memories. So it can sort of be diluted throughout your system, and therefore you can easily handle the fear experience, because more of your brain's connected to it now, and therefore it can be spread out more, and the load is shared. It's true that your memory is really important for activating emotions, and sometimes it happens even without traumatic things. It happens when you don't want it to. I think we've all had the experience of you walking down the street minding your business, then suddenly a teenage memory pops back in, you ask someone out, they laughed in your face, and apropos of nothing, it's just your mind wandering, and you just have that memory, and you suddenly just find yourself in the fetal position on the pavement, just rocking back and forth, thinking, why did I do that? But it just happens, isn't it? Your brain just throws this up. It's constantly tweaking away and working at integrating your emotional experiences into your memory, and it'll throw up some random encounters more often than not.
Life would be so much easier, I imagine, as a human. This is probably such a stupid thing to say, but without a memory, because you could just live in the present then, can you? I suppose, do cats have memories, or do they just live on instinct? I don't know. Do dogs have memories? Do birds
cats have memories? They just don't care for them.
I suppose when you're talking about it, though, you mentioned the Stoics a bit in the book, and the Stoics are very keen, aren't they, on you being able to sort of control your emotions, not so much control them, but enjoy them, more thoroughly and be aware of them. And I suppose the Buddhists are the same. I suppose with both of them, they sort of believe that if you're aware of your emotions, then if I've got this right, that once you notice your emotions, you can then, I'm going to use this word, which is probably emotion, you can enjoy them rather than hate them. And then you can start controlling them. So I suppose the bad example is PTSD and also grief, because for some reason PTSD is really hard, as we know. And grief is one that for some reason doesn't quite come into the same category. But anger, they always sort of say, if once you notice you're angry, then it quite dissipates quite quickly. And I think that's true, isn't it? If you notice you're really angry about something, because when you're angry you don't notice, but as soon as you can get yourself to notice it, it can dissipate. And the only way to get it back is by then reliving it again, and that's your fault then. I think that's what they're people say. So yeah, I don't know, is that right? We can sort of control our emotions.
Yeah, to an extent. I think the Stoics and the Buddhists, they sort of, the general stance is they don't dislike emotions. I think the Buddhist nirvana is extinguishing of the self, any sort of needs or wants. They want a state of pure intellect. But that's not necessarily to say emotions are bad, but they hold you back from that. I think they both recognize emotions as leading to irrational, illogical thinking. So you can enjoy them, but like I say, like be aware of them, which means like your conscious mind is ultimately in control, or at least just allowing things to happen. Which is, you know, as a rule of thumb, it's a good way to it's a good thing to aim for, because you know consciously you can behave more rationally and logically. You shouldn't just be beholden to every emotional impulse you have. I think it's a harder objective than people give it credit for, because you see so many people now, like online especially, as we say, who insist that I don't obey my emotions. I just think rationally and logically at all times. And you can't do that, because there's too much going on at any one time for your logical thinking, cognitive mechanisms in your brain to handle. Like you literally can't handle everything the brain's been your brain has thrown at it on a second by second basis, because the world is just too much stuff, too much going on. So a lot of time we do have to rely on our emotions to guide us. So like, oh, I'll just go this way, I'll go that way, I don't like that, I'll avoid that. These are all these emotions just making decisions for you. Not necessarily important or major ones, just ones which you don't have the bandwidth to process consciously, because otherwise you'd have to think through every single detail of every single decision or action and weigh up the pros and cons. We deal with important things, of course we do, but when it comes to just like, you know, walking down the street or avoiding things or just eating things, we tend to go, oh, I fancy that means I have an emotional leaning towards this thing. It's your emotions which is telling you this mid-level or minor decision, I'll take care of this. You concentrate on maths and quadratic equations and mortgage payments and stuff. That's your job. So you know, emotions are an essential part of our daily life. We can't do without them. Like I looked into that because when I was in the midst of grief, I thought the sci-fi cliche of just getting rid of my emotions and being a creature of pure reason is quite appealing right now.
Yeah.
But that isn't how we can work. You know, our emotions are essentially the mortar which hold the bricks of our mind together. They are essential for how we function, because they are ultimately how we make all decisions.
I wish I'd done my research on this, Dean, but I think I read that Plato had categorized, I think I remember reading this, that he's categorized good emotions and bad emotions. And I think it was Plato who did that. And I was like, hold on, why are the bad ones bad? And if you step forward from Plato's time to now, we've actually got emotions. You were just talking about social media there. We've got emotions now which are not allowed, which is ludicrous. So you're in a car, right? Someone cuts you up. You get angry, okay? Because they're threatening you. That's an absolutely healthy emotion. Yet, if you were to get angry, you see it all the time. People lose the plot on social media constantly. You know, people are videoing someone go, fuck you. You can see they've got anger. There's nothing wrong with that emotion. What is wrong is as soon as it's gone on social media, that person is not allowed to have that emotion. So we are denying, as a species, societies are denying that. You're not allowed to be jealous anymore. That's a bad emotion. I can't remember what other ones, but basically hate and jealousy and a few others. And now we're only allowed this one end of the emotions. You're allowed to be happy. You're allowed to be whatever it is, in love. You're allowed love. You're allowed to be kind. Whatever the emotions are, you're allowed. You're empathy. You're loved. You're allowed to have that wonderful feeling of empathy for people. You're not allowed to have the other ones, but we're all going through it. And that's the, I suppose that's a problem as society we've got to now, where and also, are people responsible for their emotions? I'm not sure they are. You know, if someone's getting really angry, I'm sure it's not just because of that one moment. It's probably a whole back catalogue of things leading up to it, the extreme version being PTSD, I suppose, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm on the record about this, that you're with the nail on the head. The idea that you can only be happy is such a modern invention and a deeply unhealthy one. You know, the whole live, laugh, love sort of thing. And like I'm a member of groups of like toxic positivity or frantic positivity. The idea that people will post memes now saying, you know, you can choose to have a bad attitude. Like, can I? You can choose to be happy. Well, why would I choose not to be happy? Why would anyone, if it's all in your gift, why would anyone choose to be miserable or angry? It's a really unhealthy way to live, the idea that you have to be happy at all times. Because the message is that, you know, if you aren't happy, then you are inferior. You're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And that's not how our brain works. Like, we should be happy when things are going well and some good things happen, which we want to, it's our brain teaching us to, that's a good thing. Do that again. That makes you happy. You know, seek that out. But if you're happy all the time, it becomes completely meaningless because everything is of the same, you know, has the same emotional value. So why do anything? You know, if you're happy because you've achieved this goal, if you were just as happy not doing it, then what, you wouldn't, you'd have no motivation whatsoever. And you know, the negative emotions, the ones which make us, don't make us feel good, you know, where, the valence is negative, as they say in the affective neuroscience field. These are, you know, we avoid them because we don't want to feel bad. It's a simple case of, like I say, we can choose to avoid the things which make us feel bad, but you know, you can't shut out the world forever and think bad things will happen. And if you spent your entire life, or like many years at least, avoiding any challenging emotion or any emotion you don't like, when the world inevitably gets to you, like it throws a pandemic at you where you can't avoid, you're going to have less ability to deal with that, to deal with the emotions this will produce, because you've denied yourself the opportunity to do so. I mean, the masculinity thing is a real big problem there. Like, you know, some men have a serious issue with being allowed, quote unquote, to express emotions, because we have just the same emotional range as women do. And, you know, because of the machismo in modern society, like, men are allowed to be angry because angry leads to fighting, and that's manly. But other emotions aren't allowed. You can't, you know, not so much these days. Things are changing and it's all for the better. But the idea that you can't be shown any weakness, like showing emotions is a sign of weakness or frailty or fragility or vulnerability. Maybe it is vulnerability, but that's a good thing. You know, we are human beings. We can't avoid that. But bottling them up the whole time and just telling people, like, well, I'm strong, I don't feel anything, is deeply unhealthy. And the numbers show that.
I always think with emotions, the positivity thing is, I just think that's such bullshit all the time. Positivity, positivity, positive. And then it's created a whole mass of people now, of all ages, by the way, not just the young people, who go, I don't want to feel anything bad anymore. And it's like, but then, you know, a good example of that is, if I don't want to feel grief, well, then you're not going to have anyone in your life that you like, because some of them are love, some of them are going to die, animals, pets, parents, grandparents, they will die, and you're, unless you're Mr. Spock, you're going to start feeling emotions unless you're a Vulcan, and then you have to go through grief. But you, if you don't want grief, don't have anyone in your life or anything in your life, and then you'll never feel grief. But it's part, it's, and I also think it's so dumb because everyone tunes into Netflix. I go back to this constantly, and they go tune into Netflix to try and get that massive roller coaster and rush of emotions by watching binge watching or just watching these series where they take you on a massive emotional roller coaster. And yet in their real life, they're going, no, I only want happiness, and that's what's successful, and positivity, just look at positivity, stay busy. So it's all bullshit, isn't it? We're, as a society, we've really lost touch with what actually emotions are, and I think that's why I quite like the Stoics and the Buddhists, where they go, just experience them, and I use that word in game, enjoy them. It's hard to enjoy grief or anger, but you know, but at least say it's part of the adventure, and you know, it's going to happen, accept it.
Yeah, that's exactly the right approach, in that you say grief and anger or fear, they're not fun things. Although some people do, like, you know, some people do get off on getting angry, some people do love scary films. So there's an argument to be made that it can happen, you know, the emotional impact of something, although it's objectively negative, can be enjoyable. I mean, I got a whole thing in the book about spicy food. It's a food which literally causes pain, but we enjoy it. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, but our emotions go, no, I like that now, I like that. But you're totally right in that shutting yourself off from emotional experiences is just an unhealthy way to live, and it's not practical. Because like I say, like you say, people you close to will move on, will die, will, you know, leave or whatever, just because of circumstance, because life is like that. And by shutting yourself off from them, you're not allowing your brain to do what it needs to do. And you're going to make it harder for you in the long run. So yeah, there's definitely far too much of, also there's a performative element, especially with social media, and that people, it's like the people who post memes, this is how you live a good life, this is how you be happy all the time. Or again, it's in the book of people who are very, very openly coupley on Facebook or something tend to have the least secure relationships, because it's almost like, it's almost like an instinctive fake it till you make it thing. So again, if I tell the world that our marriage or our relationship is really good and solid, that'll make it true.
Yeah,
that isn't how it works. But you know, I guess points for trying, I guess, but we need to have a better understanding of these things.
Dean, I'm going to get you cancelled now because in your book you say that men and women have different emotions and that's not acceptable in the can feel things differently, and that's not acceptable in even though there's science behind it, it's not acceptable in modern society. So explain yourself before I cancel you.
Well, you're in charge of the feed, so you can cancel me anytime you like. I can't do anything about it. No, that's actually an interesting thing in that it's the perception of what emotions men and women should have in the wider society, which seems to shape how we react emotionally to things more than the fundamental neuroscience of it. I mean, men and women do have structurally different brains in many aspects, but the functional outcome of this is a lot less than the modern world would assume. So we have different anatomical bits here. Men's brains are bigger because we have bigger bodies overall. It's the same, elephants have bigger brains than we do. So because just it's a scale thing. This idea that men are just instinctively far more focused and logical and women are far more empathetic and react emotionally to things and are, far more open books in the emotion sense, that's a cultural ideal. And we are sort of raised in a culture which assumes that's true. And because of the way our brains work, we develop in a culture where men and women are treated differently growing up in the emotional sense. So we internalize that. We learn that, okay, so this is how the world works. I am male. I do not show emotions. And I go into this in the book about my day of my father's funeral. I couldn't cry. I wanted to, really wanted to. I knew I was allowed to, and no one would have judged me. But I still couldn't clear that mental logjam until late that night when everyone else is asleep and I was alone. So no one would see me. Now, I know how illogical that is. I know that's totally unreasonable and quite unhealthy, even if I haven't cried at all. But I still couldn't get around it because that's how I've been raised. I've been told that, men have to be strong, look after the vulnerable. And even though I know that's not how anything works, the world has told me otherwise, and I've seemed to have taken that in deeply, and it's really quite, it was quite eye-opening, the extent to which I've been influenced by that. Because you think I, of all people, would be able to say, that's them, I'm not going to do that. But, knowing something and feeling it and being able to process it like that is a very different thing. Mm. I know there's some interesting studies that show that we are controlled and influenced by different hormones and chemicals depending on what sex you are. But I really like the study which showed that subjects who were told they were given testosterone in a game situation were started acting more aggressively, more forthright, and more confident, and screwed people over more. But and people who weren't given testosterone didn't do that. They reacted more cooperatively. But in truth, the ones who were told they were given testosterone weren't. They were just given a placebo. And the ones who weren't told, they were given testosterone, and they became more friendly and outgoing because that was at a deep level, humans value cooperation as much as competition. And testosterone makes us more stateless aware. And you could say, people might say, this still shows that men are so influenced by testosterone. They're just creatures of hormones. But all the subjects in this experiment were women. So women are just as easily influenced by testosterone. They just don't have as much of it. So at the basic level, it seems like our brains do operate on very similar bases, just they are programmed to, by society to do different things. Mm. So it is, the differences we see are by and large cultural as opposed to neurological. And on a neurological level, we're actually a lot more similar than your average person would assume.
I tell you, I apologize for this, but I read your book before Christmas, so I can't remember where everything all is. I just really enjoyed your book. It made me think loads, and you just reminded me there when my dad died, because emotions aren't just for me, as we said earlier, they're for other people, aren't they? And they're part of society. That's why I'm saying about what I'm saying, but the positivity, and you're saying it as well. It's dangerous if we're trying to deny emotions to everybody as well. But when my dad died, I did that same thing that you did. I didn't cry. I was kind of feeling bad and everything, obviously, and grief and everything. And then I had to FaceTime my youngest daughter to tell her. And when I did it, then as soon as her face came on, boof, the tears opened up. And it was reading, I can't remember whereabouts in your book, that I thought, oh, that's why it happened. Suddenly there's a connection that has opened up a channel, and I needed to show her the emotion. And so that's when the tears came flooding out, and it was for her more probably than me. That's how emotions manifest themselves, don't they, sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, if you can't process your own emotions, it's often a lot easier to recognize them in someone else. Because people will, they can recognize someone else's issues and give them good advice, but it's a lot harder to apply that same advice to yourself because, we're far more conscious of our own internal neuroses and we're way more aware of our internal existence than someone else is. We can look at the outside and say, okay, you're doing this. If you did that, that would stop happening. So, do that instead. And we can be objective there, but we can't with ourselves because we have way too much insight as to what else we've got going on, which is why you get, things like people scroll into Instagram and developing serious issues because you only ever see people's good stuff on there, whereas you're aware of their good stuff and you're only aware of your own bad stuff. So you seem like, I'm an absolute mess and a failure compared to these glamorous people with their filters and their Gucci bags, or I don't know what influencers do. They're just guessing expensive things right now. But but it's bad for you to sort of compare yourself to them like that. But you're right in that, don't the empathy we need sometimes, because so much of our emotional expression is about emotional communication. So once we can think to ourselves like, well, I can handle this. This is just me. I'm willing and able to suppress this for whatever reason. I need to function. But then you see someone else, like your daughter, obviously you care about more than anyone. She'll be sad, and that suddenly opens the floodgates. So, I can't stop that. I cannot stop her being sad, and that makes me much more sad because now we have sadness together, which is the real way to. I mean, I think I did it myself when I was struggling with my emotions. My father was dying and had died. I had to suppress them as best I could to stop traumatizing my kids. But then I ended up watching, at night I watched sort of moments from Pixar films, which I know were deeply emotional because it was almost like an emotional nicotine patch. As this will be a fix. This will keep me going until I can have a proper outburst at some point. So, I was doing a sort of smorgasbord of different emotional hacks and tricks to get myself through the period. It was an interesting experience.
When I had Professor Giles Yeo on this show, he was talking about diets and things like that. And he said something that really stuck with me. Every time I do a podcast, something sticks with me a lot. And he said, we have no idea how hungry another person is. And it really stuck with me that I might not be hungry ever and someone else might be starving all the time. We just have no idea. And when I was reading your book, it sort of came to me that we have no idea how sad, happy, angry everybody else is, because we have no idea where their emotions come from or their feelings. We also don't know how many emotions there are. I mean, there might be 20 different versions of it. There was definitely loads more different versions of love in different cultures, wasn't there? You talk about in your book. There's different words for different emotions. So the English language might not have a word for an emotion. The perfect one's the German one. What is it? A Schadenfreude. How do you say that?
Yeah,
Schadenfreude, which is the enjoying somebody else's misery. Have I said that correct? Is that roughly what it is?
Yeah. The pleasure and someone else's misfortune. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have that emotion. So we would just go pleasure or happiness or I don't know how we would do it. So it's such a weird thing because it's so connected to language, isn't it? That we go happy. What the hell is happy? What does happy mean? Love. What does that mean? You know, it's like I interviewed someone on here who told me there were seven different types of love. You know, it's like and there's seven things. Oh no, is it seven things that people think of love, which isn't like dependency, things like that. You know, so it's we have. The actual language of talking about emotions without actually understanding the science behind it is hard enough, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And like that makes it all the more complex to study it because when, like I say, there's no robust, agreed definition of emotions, when you're going to study them, people might end up studying sort of different things. I'm studying this. Well, I'm studying emotions too, but what do you think it is? Well, I think it's this. Well, I think it's that. So our results are wildly different. The example I use in the book is if you did a survey of how many pets are there in the UK. And one people said, well, our pet is defined as dog, cat, guinea pig, goldfish. And that's it. So you get this set number of pets, whereas someone else might be a bit more generous. Say, a pet is anything non-human that lives in your house. So that includes all the ants and all the termites and any flies are in there and spiders. So they're going to get a much bigger number because they defined it differently. So obviously these are the things which matter when you're talking about emotions. Like what is the emotion we're talking about? And a bit like you reflect in language a lot. I mean, I mentioned the Stoics, like they are believed to be the first to actually study emotions in that, you know, they think about them as individual things which can have their own properties. But they, you know, they said the ultimate expression of human consciousness is the state of apatheia, or apathy, which is not being beholden to any emotions. And that was the ultimate way a human could exist back then. But obviously that word has entered our language, and now we've got apathy, which is obviously derived from that. But to go from the ultimate expression of human consciousness to "this can't be asked" is a bit of a come down for a concept. How the mighty have fallen since then. So, but I mean, we say stoic now to mean someone who was firm and not beholden to their emotions. The history of emotions is reflected on language, and even it reveals truth. I have a little chapter in the book about color and emotions, because that enters our language a lot. You are red with anger, or you're feeling blue because you're sad, green with envy. We subconsciously recognize that certain colors have, on an almost seemingly instinctive level, a sort of an emotional property according to our brains. We react in an emotional way to these particular colors. Green is a very reassuring color for your typical human, and it's actually quite poignantly so, physically so, because people in hospitals who have a view of a green scene, like a nature park or something, or a forest, and they tend to recover faster than people with the same issues in staying at a concrete wall, because our brain finds green relaxing. It finds it reassuring, because obviously we evolved in a environment where green means life and lusciousness and resources. So being in a green place means our brain goes, okay, I can relax here because this is a good place to be. Over our many millions of years of evolution, colors and emotions have become intertwined in so many ways in our brain, and our language has developed to acknowledge that, even if we didn't mean it to.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it, to know what other people are feeling. I suppose most of our emotions do actually come from communication or contact with other humans, maybe animals too, but generally that's the way it works. The thing we've got at the moment, which is running rife, is having to have an opinion on everything. People sometimes, I've just taken this year, it's my New Year's resolution, I don't really have them, but is to not have an opinion on everything. And it's so hard because we're so programmed. What do you think of Prince Harry? Don't have an opinion.
Absolutely.
Just easier. Just don't have an opinion. Do let him do, whatever. But it's so hard not to form one. I suppose we're coming to the end here, and the big one we haven't discussed yet. You do talk about it in the book, and the one that everybody's interested in, I suppose, is the one that is the big one in my surname, love. lots of philosophers over the years have tried to define love and struggled. Have you got an understanding of the love emotion, what it is, the definition, and how it manifests itself?
It's I try going to as much depth as I could, because it is, like you say, it's the one thing people want. People, of all the emotions, happiness is the one people are constantly striving for. It's like everyone's goal, because we are such social species, and we want to have a partner to share our life with, because it's just how we are. It's our thing. Not everyone. Obviously, some people are polygamous, some people are asexual, whatever. But the average person wants to find someone to love. And that's just how it is. But there are different types of love. There is platonic love. There is parental love. There is romantic love, which obviously is the key one that everyone sort of refers to. When you say love, that's what people are thinking of. But these are all things which evolve a degree of emotional bonding and connection to another person, which is an impressive cognitive feat. We care about this person as much, at least usually more, than we do ourselves, particularly when they're not someone we are genetically linked to, because that's quite a feat to be able to do that mentally. And I think one thing I was quite interested in the book, which led me down this path, was why are, we lose a parent, and that's terribly sad. But according to all the statistics all the evaluations and stuff, it's much worse when your spouse dies. That's actually a more stressful situation. And that seems odd, people can break up with people all the time, and relationships come and go and stuff, but your parents are your parents forever. And that struck me as an odd finding. Surely that should be the other way around, if anything, because these are your closest blood relatives. But I think it's to do with my conclusion was it's to do with development, because although your parents give birth to you and they raise you, the whole point of your development is to change your relationship with your parents. You're dependent on them, and then you become less so. You become an individual. So you emotionally move away from your parents. You still obviously still stay connected to them, still love them. That's all totally fine. But you become an individual separate from them. But when it comes to a romantic partner, you work towards becoming deeply intertwined with them. So your parents, you start intertwined with them emotionally and move away from that. And with your romantic partner, you start away from them and move towards them, try to become more and more intertwined. And when you're in that state, them losing them makes it a much bigger hardship. And also, I think on a conscious level, we know that, you know, in an ideal world, our parents won't outlive us. We will outlive them. That's what they want. That's what the whole point of it is. So it's something we're consciously aware of, like when we realize these things. But you never expect that with, you know, your romantic partner. You don't expect to outlive them because there's no guarantee that'll happen and stuff. And I know obviously people with age gaps and stuff, but generally. So there's lots of different ways in which love manifests, and the impact it has on us is really quite profound. To the extent where it shapes us, it helps form our identity. You know, if you're in a long-term relationship, your romantic partner becomes a key element of your emotional expression, because you use them as a emotional sounding board, or you talk about things and talk with them.
Yeah, they always say that if you find love, your heart beats faster, your eyes dilate, the palms get sweaty or something like that. And I actually think that's probably lust rather than love, because I think love is a feeling of being content with somebody and security and calm. That must be more, because you know any love you have with your children, it's a very content, calm love, you're not going to have your pulse racing every time you see your wife. You've been married for 30 years, are you? Do you know what I mean? It's like you're going to just feel love and contentment being around each other.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how they should be. I mean, what you talk about there is passionate love. You know, the infused with lust. You know, you're in that early stage of relationship where you are obviously very sexually charged and romantically involved too, and you can't sustain that. And in an ideal world, you wouldn't. You know, you can still have a healthy sex life, but it's not going to be the obsession, the intense focus you have on your partner, for the foreseeable. And because relationships which do push that beyond normal time limits, they tend to last less, because when you're in that sort of passionate state, you become more paranoid. You become sort of, you want to isolate your partner from other people. You want to protect them and keep them. And you get suspicious of them talking to anyone else. And those are the relationships which do tend to turn relatively toxic or disruptive. And that's not good. You know, it's the calmness and contentment, which is the long-term one you want.
Out of the one emotion, love is the one that is very, very, very broad. You know, if you say something like hate, we all kind of know it, and then you have jealousy, whereas love, it encompasses so much. I blame the bloody Beatles, kept singing about it all the time.
didn't
stop banging on about love, and then everybody just thought, well, that must be it then. I must feel this constantly, you know? So what was interestingly, we're coming to the end here, Dean, but if I could just have 2 minutes more of your time, what was very interesting there is you said find someone to love, and I thought that was fascinating, that it wasn't to find someone to love me or to find someone to love them, because it feels that most, I don't know, am I being cynical here, that a lot of people's mission is I imagine I kind of went on TV so I could be loved. It didn't work. but I mean, I think people want to be loved rather than find someone to love. I love that idea. I think that's the right idea, by the way, Dean, but I wonder if it is that, or it's the other way around. I'm desperate to get someone to make me feel good about myself so I can have these emotions, these happy emotions.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think in the general sense, I think people, when they say someone to love, they mean a mutual, like reciprocated love. But because obviously when you find someone to love who doesn't love you back, that's worse. That's much worse. Nobody enjoys that. That's awful. And it's the blight of many a teenage year, isn't it? And serious crush on someone who doesn't know you. But it is, it's you want to reciprocate it, because people do want to be valued. We do want to have other people approve of us. That's a big part of our emotional expression, our emotional identity. If we think other people don't like us, that causes serious negative emotions, which is why going online and just getting abuse is genuinely damaging. You can put up with it, you can build up a thick skin, but it's harmful. It isn't sticks and stones names ever hurt me. They do. They genuinely do, because that's how we function. And that's one of the downsides of the modern world, I'm afraid.
That rejection emotion is not that I would know, Dean. Not that I've ever been rejected, but I have. And that is not a pleasant feeling, is it, when that all
No, it's
in.
Totally.
Listen, I love this book. It's a big old book, this. You put a lot of work into this, and it's fantastic. No, I really do. Thank it's you. One of those things that not enough people, we don't talk about this sort of stuff enough. And I think it's really important to sort of try and learn and understand about, especially when we, as I say, we've had this conversation where we're living in a society where we're trying to suppress emotions constantly, our own and also other people's. We're not allowing anybody. I always think when I see someone like lose it on public transport, I always think, why don't they go and put an arm around that person and find out why they've absolutely lost the plot? Instead, we try and get them sacked from their job or something. I don't think most people are bad, are they? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm looking.
I'd assume not. That's my general sense. Like, the people who express stuff in a negative way, all right, maybe you got other stuff going on, but I always like to think they're the minority, because most people don't do that. Because never get anything done if they did.
Emotional Ignorance is the name of the book, Lost and Found in the Science of Emotion. Thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to speaking to you in another 6 months when you do your next book. What are you working on next? Have you got something?
I've got a couple of books in the pipeline, so I'll I'll be in touch soon, no doubt. I'm doing a book about the way in which neuroscience is misunderstood in the wider world next, so that's hopefully going to be useful.
Oh, science! We all gave up on science years ago. We've got the social media now. We don't need you anymore.
Don't need it, do we? Build my own reality.
I can do. Yeah, I know. I know everything. I know everything about COVID. Yeah, exactly. I know it all. Cheers, Dean. Thank you so much.
Cheers, Tim. Thanks a lot, man.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.